English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines is senior Iranian commander renews Tehran's promise of harsh revenge for the U.S. assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. The U.S. breaks its own record for the number of daily coronavirus deaths by reporting nearly 4,000 new fatalities. Hong Kong says it will not tolerate what it calls subversive acts as police arrest dozens of people over an unofficial opposition vote. Our top story for this half hour, the commander of the Quds Force of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has vowed harsh revenge for the assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani.
Our duty is clear. First is to take revenge from the murderers that committed this heinous crime. The revenge began at the very first moment that they assassinated top resistance commanders, and it will reach its endpoint. But this revenge has several steps. The enemy has been slapped twice and will be slapped two more times in the future. The first was the huge funeral procession that was held for General Soleimani and his comrades. The second was an attack on the U.S. base in Iraq that broke the grandeur of America. The third slap will be when the U.S. hegemony will be defeated. And the last one will be the U.S. withdrawal from the region.
Brigadier General Ghani was speaking at a ceremony marking the first anniversary of Soleimani's assassination. The ceremony took place in Soleimani's hometown, Kerman, in southern Iran. Ghani said U.S. forces will be crushed first, and then they will be expelled from the West Asia region. He said the perpetrators of the crime will not be safe even in their own homes. The Iranian commander said the path of General Soleimani will continue. Soleimani was killed in a U.S. drone attack in Iraq last January. Iran's President Hassan Rouhani has hailed the nation's resistance against U.S. sanctions and its economic war. Rouhani said Iran has emerged victorious despite hardships caused by the U.S. sanctions. He said Iran's economy grew in spring and summer despite restrictions caused by the coronavirus pandemic. Rouhani said the country is working on new development projects and inaugurates them on a weekly basis. The Iranian president called on the new U.S. administration to commit to its international obligations and abide by law. He said if the U.S. does so, Iran will fully meet its commitments too. The United States has imposed sanctions against Iran's steel industry and seized millions of dollars of Iranian assets abroad. The sanctions have targeted a dozen Iranian steel and metal makers and a Chinese company that makes elements for steel production. Among the blacklisted firms is Iran-based Middle East Mines and Mineral Industries Development Holding Company. The U.S. Treasury Department says it's also designating the company's subsidiaries and sales agents in Germany, China, and the U.K. The U.S. Justice Department has also busted $7 million in Iranian assets. The department says the money will be used to compensate victims of state terrorism. The restrictions are part of the outgoing U.S. President's administration's maximum pressure campaign against Iran. Tehran has repeatedly condemned the sanctions, saying they amount to economic terrorism. Political commentator Jason Unruh says the new anti-Iran sanctions are part of a broader strategy by Washington to force Tehran to bow to its will on renegotiating the nuclear deal.
Well, the fact is the United States, particularly under U.S. President Donald Trump, has pursued a policy of perhaps trying to create a new JCPOA agreement. They completely just destroyed the existing one, started placing new pressure on Iran to try to get them to come to the negotiating table when there was already an agreement there. And I assume it's in order to change the terms. I suspect that perhaps the original agreement did not do the damage that they had hoped that it would. They had hoped to hold back Iran economically from the agreement, but it has not done the damage that they want is strategy to punish the Islamic Republic for not bowing to U.S. will. And this seizure of assets is just going along more with the economic war that has been placed on the country, sanctions which have no actual international standing that have been forced on the country.
The Iranian army is conducting a large-scale drill involving hundreds of domestically made drones. On the second and final day of the maneuvers, air interception operations were carried out using the army's Qatar drones. The combat aircraft tracked down mock enemy targets and destroyed them as they were flying at a high altitude. The pilotless planes also bombed mock enemy positions on the ground. The exercises are taking place in Iran's northeastern province of Samnan. The army's ground, air defense, and naval force are taking part in the drill. Participating units practice flying unmanned aerial vehicles for combat reconnaissance missions, as well as electronic warfare. The UK has entered its third lockdown as it hurtles towards the winter disaster predicted in 2020. Britain's National Health Service is at breaking point and could be overwhelmed in a matter of weeks amid a shortage of staff and beds. Bianca Rimey tells us more in this report.
The Prime Minister made the announcement Monday. The country will be going back to its 2020 mantra: stay home, protect the NHS, save lives. Boris Johnson warned there were going to be tough weeks ahead, but still offered a ray of hope.
The weeks ahead will be the hardest yet, but I really do believe that we're entering the last phase of the struggle, because with every jab that goes into our arms, we are tilting the odds against COVID and in favour of the British people. And thanks to the miracle of science, not only is the end in sight, but we know exactly how we will get there.
Some children across England had one day in school before the announcement was made, and people are vexed by yet another last-minute announcement. The opposition says the government is going to make mistakes, but to make the same mistakes again is unacceptable. But Boris Johnson insists the tier system was working and that the new variant of COVID-19 is what derailed it. The Prime Minister's remarks caused hashtags resign, school closures, and Boris has failed the UK to shoot to the top of the country's Twitter trending charts. He is accused of ignoring the science by insisting schools are safe. The third lockdown will be hard for families juggling work and school, but many companies in the leisure, retail and hospitality sectors feel they might not make it through to the spring. In response to these fears, the Chancellor of the Exchequer made an announcement Tuesday.
Well, in order to help support businesses through a difficult period through to the spring, today we've announced £4.6 billion of additional help. For businesses in the most affected sectors who are asked to close, they will receive up to £9,000 in a one-off cash grant. It's important to remember that comes on top of the existing monthly grant of £3,000 that those businesses receive, and the extension of furlough all the way through to April. You know, we remain committed to protecting jobs and supporting businesses.
The new COVID-19 restrictions come days after the UK and the EU reached a trade and security agreement as part of their Brexit divorce deal, and businesses in Britain had to start trading differently. They were dreading this, but now they say planning around COVID-19 restrictions has made the extra paperwork surrounding post-Brexit trade pale into insignificance. Bianca Rahimi, London.
The U.S. has shattered its previous record for the number of daily deaths from COVID-19 after reporting nearly 4,000 fatalities in one day. The world's worst-hit country also recorded more than 250,000 new cases of the coronavirus. So far, the virus has claimed over 357,000 lives out of more than 21 million confirmed cases. The number of people hospitalized is also at its highest since the beginning of the pandemic, with more than 131,000 patients occupying beds. The latest figures come as the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says COVID-19 was likely to be known as the third leading cause of death in the U.S. in 2020. Vote counting is underway in Senate runoff elections in the U.S. state of Georgia with knife-edge margins. Almost 98% of the votes have been counted. Democratic candidate Raphael Warnock has been projected as the winner of one of the two runoffs again in Georgia against Republican Senator Amy Loeffler. The other contest between Democrat John Ossoff and incumbent Republican David Perdue continues neck and neck. The outcome of the Georgia elections will determine which party would gain control of the Senate. Republicans need the victory of either of their candidates to preserve their majority. In the Senate, Democrats, however, must gain control over both seats to capture a majority in both houses of the U.S. Congress. Colin Campbell joined us earlier with a breakdown of why the Senate races are decisive for the U.S. politics.
Right now, if the Republicans win, that would mean that they have a majority in the Senate. If President-elect Joe Biden, or when President-elect Joe Biden becomes president and he wants legislation passed, Republicans can block that legislation. So anything progressive or democratic that the Democrats want to put forward to change the country or just to change the growing wealth disparity, the COVID-19 vaccine rollout, some of the police brutality issues and justice and racism issues, those may not come to the fore if you have Republicans in the Senate that can block a lot of that activity. Now, the flip side is, if the Democrats win, well, then you have a possibility of the 50-50 split, right? Each state gets two senators. And the person who would break that tie would be the vice president, who would be a Democrat. Vice President-elect Kamala Harris would be the vice president. She would break any ties on legislation that just goes straight down partisan lines.
Protesters have rallied in Washington, D.C. ahead of the affirmation of U.S. President-elect Joe Biden's victory in the November presidential election. Demonstrators supporting President Donald Trump came out to show frustration at the outcome of the race for the White House. Police at some point fired tear gas to disperse the protesters. Similar rallies are planned by multiple pro-Trump groups for Wednesday. That's when Joe Biden's win is slated to be certified by Congress. President Trump has said he will address the rally of his supporters on Wednesday. Authorities in the U.S. Capitol have already boosted security. The city has mobilized the National Guard and issued a warning to protesters against carrying any sort of firearms. Hong Kong's security secretary says the regional government will not tolerate what he calls subversive acts. John Lee was speaking at Hong Kong's Legislative Council. He said a group of people had been arrested in the city. Lee said the arrests are part of an operation targeting people suspected of overthrowing the government. Hong Kong police said 53 people were arrested. They are said to be tied to an unofficial vote in July 2020 to select opposition candidates for a postponed legislative election. The arrests were made under a national security law China passed in June. Hong Kong opposition says the law would curtail freedoms there. Beijing says it would boost security in the city. Saudi Arabia has finally decided to lift a border blockade on Qatar. The move is seen as a major step toward ending a diplomatic rift that saw Riyadh leading an alliance to isolate Doha for over 3 years. We have a report.
Saudi Arabia seems changing its diplomatic course with regard to neighboring Qatar as years-long blockade by Riyadh and some of its allies failed to force Doha to bow to their demands. The Kuwaiti foreign minister announced a diplomatic breakthrough, saying Saudi Arabia has decided to reopen its air, land, and sea borders to Qatar.
Based on the suggestion of Sheikh Nawaf al-Ahmad al-Sabah, Emir of the state, an agreement has been reached for the reopening of land and sea borders between the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and the state of Qatar starting tonight.
Following the announcement, Qatar's Emir Sheikh Tamim bin Hamad al-Thani accepted an invitation to attend a regional Arab summit in Saudi Arabia. Upon his arrival to the Saudi city of Al-Ula, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman gave a warm welcome to Sheikh Tamim. In the summit, the leaders of the six-member Persian Gulf Cooperation Council signed a rapprochement agreement, although the details were not immediately released.
These efforts helped us reach the agreement of the Al-Ula statement that will be signed at this summit, where we affirm our Arab and Islamic solidarity and stability.
During the meeting, however, bin Salman missed no chance to repeat his anti-Iran rhetoric, describing Tehran's missile program as a threat to the region. But what actually had caused the conflict between Doha and Riyadh? In June 2017, Saudi Arabia, together with Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates, and Egypt, accused Qatar, among other things, of meddling in regional affairs and supporting terrorism. They cut ties and transport links with Qatar. Ironically, Saudi Arabia is accused of the same charges it is leveled against Qatar. Doha also repeatedly denied the allegations and said it was targeted because it followed an independent foreign policy. The boycotting countries then issued a list of 13 demands to Doha, including a downgrade in relations with Iran and the closure of the Al Jazeera television news network in return for the reconciliation. Qatar has not publicly bowed to any of the demands. Saudi Arabia has constantly pursued a policy of fueling regional tensions. Some of its allegations against Qatar even demonstrated Saudi hypocrisy, as the kingdom has long been engaged in regional conflicts. While its interference in Libya and Bahrain, as well as its anti-Iran rhetoric, is not hidden anymore, the kingdom's full-fledged war on impoverished Yemen has also exposed its hegemonic agenda. Undoubtedly, Riyadh's decision to ease the Qatar blockade proves the failure of its policy of siege and aggression. However, the credit goes to Doha, that stood firm against what it called bullying by some Arab states, and so were the Qatari citizens, who seemed galvanized by patriotic feelings.
Palestinian resistance factions in the blockaded Gaza Strip have expressed grave concerns over the health condition of thousands of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails in light of the coronavirus pandemic. Palestinian prisoners are at high risk due to an imminent outbreak of the highly contagious virus in Israel's densely crowded prisons and detention centers. Nasher Shannon has more in this report.
Palestinian resistance factions have held an extraordinary meeting at the Ministry of Palestinian Detainees Affairs to discuss the rising number of coronavirus infections among Palestinian prisoners inside Israeli jails. Currently, some 5,000 Palestinian prisoners, including women and minors, are being held in 24 Israeli prisons and detention facilities. Nearly 200 Palestinian prisoners have been infected with the deadly coronavirus. Hamas movement accused Israeli prison guards of spreading the coronavirus among Palestinian prisoners.
They hold the Israeli regime fully responsible for health and well-being of Palestinian prisoners inside its jails, especially amid the spread of coronavirus among the prisoners. Israeli prison guards are intentionally spreading the virus among Palestinian prisoners. We call on all international human rights organizations to step in and save the lives of Palestinian prisoners.
According to Palestinian officials, Israeli prisons are potential epicenters of the pandemic due to overcrowding and lack of personal distancing in Israeli jails. During a press conference following their meeting, Palestinian resistance factions demanded international protection for prisoners amid the coronavirus pandemic.
Palestinian resistance factions and the Ministry of Detainees Affairs condemn Israeli policies against the prisoners, especially that 184 detainees have been infected so far with the coronavirus. The number of infections among prisoners is increasing rapidly under the watchful eye of the international community.
The Israeli regime has repeatedly taken reckless measures that threaten the lives of Palestinian prisoners. Last year, the Israeli Supreme Court ruled that Palestinian prisoners have no right to social distancing protection against the highly infectious disease.
The Zionist regime is perpetrating all sorts of crimes against Palestinian prisoners, including medical negligence. The coronavirus is spreading at a very high pace inside Zionist prisons. The Zionist prisons refuse to give the coronavirus vaccine to Palestinian prisoners under the direct order of the Zionist Minister of Public Security.
The statistics show that over 200 Palestinian detainees have died in Israeli prisons since 1967 due to medical negligence.
Thousands of Palestinian prisoners are languishing inside Israeli jails. They are now gripped by the fear of coronavirus spread due to the inhumane detention conditions. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
And that's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight.
American police violence is off the charts compared to other developed countries, with homicides occurring at a per capita rate almost 70 times that of the UK and nearly 170 times more than Japan, says Alan McLeod Ryder in an article titled Killer Cops. U.S. police killed over 1,000 Americans in 2020. Stay tuned, please, for the details. American law enforcement officers have killed well over 1,000 people in 2020. Between January 1st and December 15 of 2020, the Mapping Police Violence Project has recorded 1,066 people nationwide killed at the hands of the police, an average of around 3 killings per day. Despite the fact that 2020 has brought with it a pandemic forcing Americans to stay off the streets and presumably out of trouble as much as possible, there have only been 17 days recorded this year where the police did not kill someone. The project also compiled statistics on the racial backgrounds of the victims. Black people are 3 times more likely than white people to be slain by police and more likely to be unarmed when it does happen. 8 of the 100 largest city police departments kill black men at a higher clip than the U.S. murder rate. Those 8 are Reno, NV, Oklahoma City, Santa Ana, CA, Anaheim, CA, St. Louis, Scottsdale, AZ, Hialeah, FL, the Madison, and WI. Death by cop is a leading cause of death for black males in the U.S., killing 1 in 1,000. U.S. police violence is off the charts in comparison to other developed countries, with homicides occurring at a per capita rate almost 70 times that of the United Kingdom, or nearly 170 times more than Japan. This puts it closer to many Latin American nations, notorious for their corrupt and militarized police departments' heavy-handed response to drug smuggling and organized crime. May 3rd was the deadliest day in 2020, with police killing 9 men in California, Colorado, Florida, Indiana, Kansas, North Carolina, and Texas. Perhaps the most infamous day came 3 weeks later, however, when police killed 7 men, among them 46-year-old African-American George Floyd. Floyd would likely have been as anonymous as the other 1,065 names on the list had the incident not been caught on camera and gone viral on social media, causing a worldwide uproar. Video showed Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin pressing his knee into Floyd's neck for nearly 9 minutes until he suffocated to death, even as onlookers pleaded with him not to kill him. Floyd's final words, "I can't breathe," became a rallying cry, sparking hundreds of large demonstrations nationwide. Between 15 and 26 million Americans are estimated to have attended at least one related protest in the subsequent weeks. As a response to the demonstrations, Chauvin was arrested and charged with second-degree unintentional murder and second-degree manslaughter. He was released on bail in October. However, his situation is unusual. Mapping police violence numbers show that only 1.7% of killer cops are ever charged with a felony, and far fewer are actually convicted, meaning there are very rarely any serious negative consequences for those that do kill while in uniform. The protest sparked a nationwide debate about the role of the police in the society, with polls showing that up to 39% of the U.S. approved of the measure to defund the police. Even more popular were actual police proposals of removing police responsibility for situations like mental health crises and homelessness, measures that would make up the backbone of any police defunding agenda. Despite being responsible for hundreds of brutality incidents during the subsequent protest and hundreds more attacks on journalists, police themselves claimed to be under assault. After a police officer was killed in Washington State in July, the institution's defenders suggested that the Black Lives Matter protests were morally responsible. Anytime the anti-police rhetoric heats up, it sends a message that it's open season on law enforcement. We saw it in 2016, and we are seeing it in 2020, a retired senior Secret Service agent told ABC News. Yet, the U.S. government's own data does not back this up. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, law enforcement is not a particularly dangerous profession. Virtually any other job performed mostly outside, from construction work and gardening to agriculture, fishing, and forestry, all carry far more risk of death than being a police officer. Also more dangerous are professions where driving a vehicle, such as garbage collection, delivery driving, or trucking, is a key component of the job. The 2020 presidential election was colored by the debate around police violence, with the incumbent president, Donald Trump, accusing Joe Biden of being in the pockets of radical anti-police leftists. In reality, however, Biden appeared hesitant to criticize the police at all, initially suggesting only that they shoot suspects in the leg rather than in the torso. The 78-year-old Delawarean also chose former prosecutor Kamala Harris, who described herself as California's top cop, as his running mate, all of which suggests that it is unlikely Americans will see a massive drop in police violence figures come 2021.
the debate.
Hello and welcome to the debate. I'm Behrouz Najafi. An affront to justice. That's how the UN has described President Trump's recent pardons for Blackwater mercenaries. Rights experts complain that a pardon for the four security contractors convicted of killing Iraqi civilians in 2007 undermines humanitarian law. UN experts have reminded the fact that based on the Geneva Convention, war criminals must be held accountable for their crimes even when acting as private security contractors. That's the topic of our debate show tonight. Stay with us for that. Now let's go to Washington, D.C. to our own correspondent, Dr. Colin Campbell. Colin, last week we were discussing the same issue from a different angle, and there was media blackout. Majority of mainstream U.S. media didn't mention this. Now the UN has taken it to a different level. It's now some kind of legal challenge. What about now?
That's right, and it looks like the media has picked up on it a little bit, really expressing outrage from some of the commentators that have remarked about the pardons that the president made for these contractors from Blackwater. As we understand, this was an egregious crime that was committed with the slaughter of innocent Iraqi civilians that were later the perpetrators of this crime, now can walk free. So you have some media outlets, if they aren't just saying and stating what happened as a declarative, they're expressing outrage, anger, and just disbelief that these would be the people that the president has pardoned. Now, what is being looked at also is just the whole pardoning process. I think that the president has put a test on the whole system of who is pardoned and why. Usually it is for people who were not afforded equity in under the eyes of the law. Maybe there was a law that was misapplied, or maybe something that was done unjudiciously, or something that was done a little bit too exacting or too draconian in method. Well, this time it seems that this was the president's privilege that he took to pardon people that he felt should be pardoned, or some people who were giving deference to the president. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why there are many people who are now questioning just the whole system of who is pardoned. Again, this is not the main story that is coming from U.S. media, but it is something that is being discussed, especially amongst those who are at liberty to discuss the topics of the day with a little bit more freedom in their rhetoric rather than just mm-hmm. stating the news of the day as a flat declarative.
Okay, thank you, Doc. Our own Colin Campbell in Washington, D.C. Now, joining me to discuss this a little bit and look at it from different angles, first will be former independent expert with the UN Human Rights Council, Alfred Desaires, out of Geneva. Good to have you with us, Alfred. Welcome to the show. And, these security contractors took the lives of Iraqi civilians back in 2007. On what ground has President Trump pardoned them?
Well, we have a culture of impunity in the United States, and this is only one of many cases. Constitutionally, the president does have the authority to pardon criminals, except that in this case, basically, he's giving his blessing on murder, his blessing on a massive war crime. But it's not just the practice of granting pardons. It's also the consistent pattern of impunity for American soldiers who commit crimes and for private security companies whose members, and we had nearly 100,000 private security officials in Iraq at the time, and there were many other major crimes committed. It's not just this one in Nusra Square in 2007. I remember the crimes committed at the time of the rape of Fallujah, and we know the crimes committed in Guantanamo as a daily torture situation that has been repeatedly condemned by United Nations rapporteurs. And all of these persons involved in these crimes have enjoyed and continue enjoying impunity. As an American, I can say not in my name. I mean, I find it egregious, I find it outrageous. But as Campbell just said, the mainstream media doesn't like to carry these stories. I recall when I was a young student at Harvard, that was during the Vietnam War, and there were all of these war crimes committed by American soldiers against the Vietnamese people, civilians, women, children. Very little made it to the press, and it was us, the activists, the students, who were protesting because we had heard about these things and we wanted to see accountability on the part of American soldiers. Who was tried? This insignificant Lieutenant William Calley, instead of trying General Maxwell Taylor, instead of holding the hires up accountable for the systematic crimes being committed in Vietnam, and for decades now, since the beginning of the so-called War on Terror, we have had a problem of so-called secret prisons, the problem of extraordinary renditions. Mm-hmm. And my colleague and rapporteur on human rights while combating terrorism, Ben Emerson, did a study on extraordinary renditions. And it turned out that 54 countries in the world participated in the extraordinary renditions. And countries like Poland, Romania, Egypt, etc., all participated in this completely illegal program of kidnapping and sending people to be tortured. I mean, we had special agreements with Egypt, and we sent people specifically to be tortured in Egypt. Wow. And of course, we continued the torture in Guantanamo, and as I said, in total impunity, because no one has ever been held accountable.
Okay. Now let me also invite Sina Ellis with Foreign Policy and Focus, Ian Williams, out of New York. Good to have you with us, sir. Ian, rights groups argue that allowing private security firms like Blackwater to operate with impunity in armed conflicts will embolden the states to circumvent their obligations under humanitarian law. Is that true?
Yeah, quite clearly. I was present at the first, the negotiations that led to the signing of the UN, of the International Criminal Court. Mm-hmm. And I spoke to a lot of the State Department and U.S. military analysts and lawyers who were involved. And their sincere thesis was that because the law only allowed for prosecution if the state concerned had failed, then it was okay. You know, Americans were protected because they said, we have the best military justice system in the world. I had memories of Milei, like our other interlocutor there, where you might remember it took something like 30 years for the pilot of the helicopter that stopped the massacre to be recognized by Bill Clinton. But Bill Clinton was the president at the time and was at least paying lip service when the treaty was signed. We know that the U.S. couldn't ratify it because of Republican opposition, and it's on the basic same principle. The U.S. can never do any wrong. I mean, it's American exceptionalism to the max. First of all, the U.S. can do no wrong. And secondly, that anyone wearing a uniform must be supported, which we're seeing with police impunity, with military impunity. No, okay, he shot somebody in full daylight who was unarmed, but he's a policeman doing his duty, so we must support him. It's that attitude that pervades the whole system. And it really has come out here because these people were, that they were paid security guards. That they were like the doorman in a nightclub. I mean, it's like giving the bouncer in a nightclub the option to kill people at will. And internationally, that's how it will be seen. This was a clear massacre. Not the only one, by the way. They haven't even tried to investigate the massacre in the square that WikiLeaks revealed, where a helicopter up in the air gunned down a Reuters camera crew and then gunned down the people who went to rescue them and give them medical aid. That hasn't even been investigated yet, let alone prosecuted. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, this is a whole level of impunity which needs examination. Of course, we know, in fact, that the people who leaked that, they are being persecuted by the government, but not the people who kept it secret, who did it, who ordered it, who provided the circumstances, empowered those people to go in and kill civilians. And it's bad for the US in every way, not just morally, but if you're going to be cynical, it means that their word is worth nothing when it comes to looking for war criminals abroad. Who would hand over somebody to the United States as a suspected war criminal, knowing the United States' partial record, where that they protect the guilty when it's theirs and persecute the innocent when they're foreigners?
Okay. Now back to Geneva. Alfred, UN rights experts are also warning that pardons and amnesties, I'm quoting them, open doors for future abuses when states use the service of private military and security companies for inherent state functions. Do you share the same opinion?
Well, I written that in some of my own reports to the Human Rights Council and to the General Assembly. Indeed, in the ontology of the state is to keep an army and to keep discipline in that army. The main problem with private security companies is that it's an attempt to outsource this ontological responsibility of the state. And there, the so-called status of forces abroad agreements that essentially grant them total immunity in the countries where they're operating, in this case, Iraq, on the assumption that if they commit a crime, that they will be under in personam jurisdiction of United States courts, and that the military will actually investigate those allegations of war crimes, and that those responsible will be brought to justice. Well, here we have four individuals from Blackwater who were, in fact, brought to court and convicted back in 2014 for murder. Now, it is a disgrace for a country under the rule of law that it would be tolerated that a crime as egregious as this one would be subject to pardoning. But as Mr. Trump said, these were people who had a long history of service to our nation, and therefore they deserve being pardoned. Now, this is like a mafia boss saying, well, they're my boys. You know, my boys are good boys. And that, when I was a young student in high school in Chicago, I mean, I remember the kind of daily indoctrination, if you want. You know, I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What does that mean? Is that we are indoctrinated in believing that we, Americans, are, by definition, the good guy. We're always the good guy. Our soldiers do not commit war crimes. Our private military security officers do not commit war crimes. Only the other side commits war crimes. And that's why what we need is universal jurisdiction.
Right.
So that countries other than the United States, when an American official goes to, say, Switzerland, if he is, say, the Minister of Defense, and he comes to Switzerland, well, he has responsibility for all the war crimes that have been committed under his jurisdiction, right, if he has not ensured accountability. Mm-hmm. So universal jurisdiction is a concept that has to be played in.
Right. Now, Ian, in a statement announcing this controversial pardons just a few days ago, the White House said that the move was broadly supported by the public and also backed by a number of Republican lawmakers. Is that really the case?
Well, I'm fairly sure it was backed by a large number of Republican lawmakers because they're looking over their shoulders at the the Trump supporters who will or won't vote for them. I mean, you know, if Adolf Hitler had the good sense to wear a GI's uniform, these people would all be supporting him, no problem. But on the other side, they if they were putting when we're talking about the public. Is the public aware of it? That's the real problem. And I think my colleague here was making the point, the public is not aware of most of this stuff. Mm-hmm. If you ask them about Milei, it's not on their list of battles. If you ask them about Abu Ghraib, if you ask them about Guantanamo, this is not big on the mental horizon. It's an issue that's buried very thoroughly. If it's brought up at all by the media, it's very likely. Because the media has exactly the same prejudices. Our guys are right, the other side are wrong. If our guys are wrong now and again, then we should cut them some slack because they're doing this for us after all. I mean, there is a cult of the uniform and the veteran here in the United States, which pervades everything. A veteran, I mean, you know, a veteran can do no wrong. In fact, lots of veterans do wrong. And, you know, the whole point of people in uniform is you're training them to go abroad and kill people. Mm-hmm. And they often do it, you know, excessively and with too much zeal. And so people do feel sympathy for them. You know, I've spoken, everyone calls the Second World War the finest war. I've spoken to many veterans who tell horrifying stories about what happened to prisoners who fell into their hands if they were inconvenient. And, but they're just ignored. People know about them, but the reality is obscured to preserve this overall vision that the United States is a city on a hill. It's not just the United States, of course. Lots of other countries. The British have never held responsible those who committed atrocities in Kenya or in South Yemen or in India, come to think of it, the other places that where they're involved. The French have never come to terms with Algeria. So, you know, it's not a uniquely American problem,
right.
But it is because America is, the United States is the sort of founding partner of the United Nations, keeps saying it's taking action to uphold international law. Its actions against Iran are wreathed in the obligations to under international law and order, and yet it completely flouts it whenever it suits them. And in this particular case, there were options. I mean, Donald Trump could have said, oh, well, look, these guys, they were young, they're in a terrible situation, so I'll exercise clemency. We'll commute their sentences. But he didn't. He said a pardon. And the pardon implies this is all right, that they are, in effect, judicially speaking, innocent.
Alfred, you both talked about, Ian talked about global jurisdiction. The ICC, ICJ, I mean, the U.S. does not recognize, you know, these international tribunals. So we have had a long record of the U.S. doing things, similar things since the Korea War, the things that the U.S. did in Afghanistan, you know, the UN probe about it and all that. So is there a remedy to this exceptionalism, U.S. forces always being good guys, infallible, great, you know, guys who never do anything wrong?
Well, it's up to us Americans to make sure that our fellow Americans, shall we say, grow up and realize that exceptionalism is not the way forward. But we still live in this bubble, and we still believe that we are the good guys. And it took me decades, actually, to separate myself from that, to, say, jump over my own shadow, to think outside the box. Not everybody does that. Here you are in your comfort zone. But while we're talking about universal jurisdiction, I mean, this can be done, and actually it has occurred. Back years ago, 2007 or 2008, when Donald Rumsfeld went to a right-wing group to speak in Paris, he had to escape because there was a warrant for his arrest. And he left Paris, and he went into Germany and was flown back to the United States with a military plane. So you see that there is a possibility under international law to prosecute for war crimes, crimes against humanity, and under the Convention Against Torture, which the United States has ratified.
Right.
Under the Convention Against Torture, there is an obligation of the territorial state to arrest and try whatever person is within its jurisdiction, in its territory, like Donald Rumsfeld at that moment,
right,
who is accused of having committed torture. That is, not he personally, but he as the responsible minister whose soldiers committed torture in Guantanamo and elsewhere. Let me just say one point.
Okay, we have only a few seconds left.
Assange and Snowden, we demand absolutely, and we must demand as Americans, that the president grant pardon both to Julian Assange and to Edward Snowden, both of whom are human rights defenders.
Okay.
And they have done more for the world than many others, and I think that the campaign against Assange is disgraceful. My colleague Niels Meltzer, rapporteur on torture, has specifically written to Donald Trump and demanded a pardon for...
Okay, Alfred, unfortunately, that's all the time we have. We are out of time. Thank you very much for your comments. We had senior analyst with Foreign Policy and Focus, Ian Williams, out of New York, and former independent expert with the UN Human Rights Council, Alfred Desaias, out of Geneva. And your host, Behrouz Najafi.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except him, and he has enjoined kindness to parents.
The first type of right that Imam Sajjad alayhi salam speaks about in his treatise is the right of God, the right of Allah, Haqqullah.
For humanity. A commentary on Risalatul Huquq of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam.
By Hujjatul Islam, Zayd As-Salam.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. Dear listeners, and welcome to IRIB English Radio and another episode of For Humanity. We're discussing the treatise of rights of Imam Ali al-Sajjad Zain al-Abidin, peace be upon him, and we're talking about loaning money and the creditor and debt collecting and everything related to that. What are the huquq, what are the rights in this particular area? And we're here talking about the last segment of what it is that Imam Sajjad has spoken about, and that is when you are not able to give that money back, what do you do? How do you behave? We know that al-kalimatu tayyibah sadaqah, that nice words are a form of charity. We know that you are aware that it is wajib, it is obligatory for you to be paying that money back. And at the same time, you know that all of these things, you are in favor towards that person who was kind enough to give you that amount of money. But now, you didn't make your calculations right. You thought that you were going to get a certain amount of money back, but unfortunately, you haven't been able to do so. So here the Imam is saying that be nice, be kind. وَأَرْضَيْتَهُ بِحُسْنِ الْقَوْلِ, because you, this itself will have a wonderful impact on that particular person. When you are postponing and delaying, it is very bad, it's very evil. And especially if you are able to do so, you need to always keep the intention of paying that amount of money. Be nice and be polite, or else you are going to be punished by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. You're also going to stop anyone else from wanting to do something good like that. And this is exactly why Imam Sadiq, peace be upon him, he says that if someone borrows a loan from somebody else and does not intend to pay it back, you know how we spoke about postponing and delaying and some people not even wanting to pay the money back. مَنْ اسْتَدَانَ دَيْنًا فَلَمْ يَنْوِي قَضَاهُ كَانَ بِمَنْزِلَةِ السَّارِقِ. If someone borrows an amount of money as a loan and doesn't intend to pay it back, it is like as if they are a thief. They are stealing that amount of money. And it means that your punishment will be similar to that of a thief. This is a big problem in our society. And if you were to ask any person around you, they would also say that they have this bad experience of loaning an amount of money to somebody and never seeing that money back again, which is very sad and very unfortunate. Sometimes they might even be religious people and you give them an amount of money and the money is gone, nowhere to be seen anymore. If you are in debt, you need to understand that you have a responsibility, you have an accountability, especially you need to be loyal to your words. You need to be committed to what you say. You don't want to feed your children haram. We're going to go for a short break and we will be back very soon.
Dear listeners, you're listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back again, dear listeners. And we were speaking about understanding the responsibility that we have if we are in loan. And it's never going to go away. We're always going to be responsible for that until we pay it back. It will be in our dhimma. That person is going to expect us to pay it back. And if we do have the financial capacity, then we're doing wrong to them. We are doing dhulm to them. If we don't even intend to pay it back, then it's a form of theft. And it is, of course, even worse of a sin. So you need to make sure that person who loaned you that money is happy, is radi, is content with what it is that you're doing. Respect them, honor them, tell them, explain to them why you can't pay that money back. And inshallah, they will be understanding. Treat them with goodness the same way as they treated you with goodness. Because ultimately, you might not be able to pay that money back. And that's why it is important to see all of these things. Why is it not good for you to loan money or borrow some money? Because you might not be able to pay it back. So bring your demands down. Don't be